she inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. This is Gina Murphy Darling, and you are indeed listening to Mrs. Green's World, and an inspirational and informative place where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I just have to get really personal here. I believe that this show is all about what this country needs right now. It's going to be a great show. I want to thank all of you for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. And always a big thanks to one of our amazing partners, the Fairfax Companies. They are true leaders in the business of sustainability. They recycle green and post-construction waste. They recycle styrofoam. And if there's a way to keep anything out of the landfills, the Fairfax Companies tries to figure it out. I am a big fan, and they are big supporters of us. So thank you, Fairfax Companies. If you want to learn more about them and their corporate stewardship and leadership, please visit them at thefairfaxcompanies.com. And when I say this is going to be a fun and informative show about a man who is accomplishing things with our oceans that you may not have thought possible, that you may have never heard about, I will say that it will truly give you hope at a time, as I said, when I think we can all use quite a bit of that. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Bren Smith. He's the owner of Thimble Island Ocean Farm and executive director of Green Wave. Bren pioneered the development of restorative 3D ocean farming, which we're going to find all about. And he's called a visionary by Barton Seaver, who's the director of Harvard's Healthy and Sustainable Food Program, because his farming model is designed to restore ocean ecosystems, mitigate climate change, and create what I love, the title blue-green jobs for fishermen, while ensuring healthy local food for communities. So it's, as we say in the Southwest, the whole green enchilada, and I'm really happy to hear that. So, Bren, it's great to finally have you with us since I met you at Bioneers in October, and I'm so excited to hear your story and have you share it with the people that are part of Mrs. Green's World and care about this great planet of ours. And I thought about...
Thanks so much for having me on. Let me lower the bar and just say I'm just a regular guy trying to, you know, figure out how to grow food in the ocean.
You know, I have to say this, observing you at Bioneers, you know, kind of being a little stalker myself, you are that. You are down to earth, you're accessible, you care, the people that were with you care, I met your wife. It's like, yeah, this is the real deal, but what you're doing, you know, as Marianne Williams says, don't play small, mister, because you have a big job to do. So it's like, yeah, you are down to earth, but you've got a lot to do given the challenges we face as a planet. And I think it'd be great if you just started off. I mean, you took to the oceans literally when you're 15 years old. So tell us a little bit about that and your journey.
Sure. So, yeah. So I grew up in Newfoundland, Canada, you know, a little tiny fishing village, you know, red, blue greenhouses just perched on the edge of the cliffs, fishermen's co-op next door. And I mean, it was just, I think to my parents' chagrin, I was just destined to head out to sea and head out early. So I dropped out of high school when I was 14 and, you know, went and fished in Newfoundland and Gloucester and Lynn, Grand Banks, George's Banks out there on the East Coast. I was doing tuna and lobster, and then I was in the Bering Sea doing, I did salmon, and then I did cod and crab. So sort of you name it, I fished it over the years.
And then you had a lot of things happen. I mean, you had some pretty serious experiences, and we talk about extreme climate change and extreme weather. So your passion led you to turn into a shell fisherman, if I have the story right, and I really hope I do. And then there was Hurricane Irene and Hurricane Sandy. And you literally, I mean, I read a lot more when I left Bioneers and before the show, and you had a really serious experience when you were going out to sea too soon after Hurricane Sandy, and it was it Irene or Sandy? I don't remember which one. And you got taken out to the rocks. So what happened there?
Yeah, I guess. Well, let me just back up a little bit and say, you know, if I look at the arc of my life, my job on the ocean has been, you know, in my career has been severely impacted by two ecological crises. And I think from a fisherman's point of view, environmental challenges really aren't about birds and bears and bees, but really about making a living. You know, we're not, if we kill our oceans, you know, we say there aren't going to be any jobs on dead planets. So I become an environmentalist as through a lens of how do I keep working? How do I stay in my boat? How, you know, a sign of success environmentally for me would be that I die in my boat one day. Like that would be cool. That's a wonderful dream for me. But so what happened when I was on the Bering Sea, and so it was classical industrial fishing as we all know it, but I didn't know it then. I was a kid, you know, it's a great, beautiful job. But we were tearing up entire ecosystems with our trawls. We were chasing fewer and fewer fish further and further out to sea, fishing in illegal waters. And most of the fish I was catching was actually going to McDonald's. So as a kid, and literally the most unsustainable form of food production on the planet, producing the lowest quality food. Now, I'll say that I miss it so much because, you know, like, in the humility of being in 40-foot seas, you know, like just the excitement, the solidarity of being in the belly of a boat with a bunch of other people for 3 months at a time. And most importantly, I think, is the sense of meaning of helping feed my country. There are certain professions in the U.S. that I think have bring an entire culture and identity. I think coal mining actually does. I think fishing, farming, and I'm sure there are others. But I was really proud of my role in the economy and in the food system. But anyway, so when I was out there, then the cod stocks crashed back home in Newfoundland.
Right.
And thousands of people were thrown out of work. Right? And that's the first moment where you realize, God, it takes hundreds of years to build up an economy, a culture around a resource, and it can be gone in literally in a matter of months. Right? And so that's we have to keep that in mind as we enter into the climate era. But then I headed to the aquaculture farms in northern Canada, because that was supposed to be the answer to overfishing, job creation, food security, things like that. But instead what we did, I was just a worker, but when we look back, it was really Iowa pig farms and sea. It was taking all the mistakes we made in land-based industrial agriculture and just applying them to the ocean, pesticides, antibiotics, terrible tasting food, pollution, the whole thing. So I think my journey has really been an attempt to take those lessons of industrial fishing, take those lessons of industrial farming, take the lessons of industrial aquaculture and not repeat them. Like, how do we use the oceans as a blank slate to do food right for the first time? And I can talk a little bit about climate change if you want. I just don't want to ramble on too long.
No, you're not rambling. You're a great storyteller. And that's what, you know, it's like I thought about when I was, you know, writing up all these questions, I thought I should just say, Bren, let her rip. You can talk. And
well,
you're
I'm
so
just,
passionate.
I'm
it's
a
like,
hick.
Let's do it.
Yeah, I'm a hick that spends way too much time in the bar. That's my only skill set. But anyway, so then I made my way down to, after I left the aquaculture farms, I think a whole generation of us were kind of in the search for sustainability. But we didn't even know really what that meant at the time. So I ended up in Long Island Sound. And they were opening up shell fishing grounds for the first time in 150 years to attract young fishers back into this new industry.
Right.
So I remade myself as an oysterman just at the beginning of that sort of boutique oyster craze.
Right.
And, you know, the emergence, all the brand names. And it was a big shift for me. I mean, I was no longer chasing things. I was kind of boring. I float around in the water. I always know what, you know, I'm more like an arugula farmer than a fisherman. I definitely can't go to my same bars I used to. I'll get beat up, right? So I got to go hang out with these, like, Zen mushroom and arugula farmers. But so there's a really an identity change. But anyway, so I did that for about 7 years. And then the storms hit. Another major wake-up call for me. Hurricane Irene, Hurricane Sandy, 2 years in a row wiped out 90% of my crop and most of my gear washed out to sea. And that's when, you know, I find myself on the front lines of a climate crisis that's happening 100 years earlier than we expected. This was supposed to be a slow lobster boil. Instead, it's like here and now, and it's affecting those of us that grow food. So that day that you mentioned was it was after Irene, and I went out too early. The storm was just settling down, and went out to try to save my gear, and we were getting hit so hard that my hauler broke, and my engine died, and I sort of started heading towards the rocks, and we had to call the Coast Guard, had to get pulled off, and it was just part of that sort of trying to fight this air of climate change.
Yeah,
like, can I, as one person, fight the weather?
Save your stuff. Yeah, save your equipment.
Exactly.
It's your living.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So out of that, it's sort of a hard couple, weeks, and really realizing I can't run my business in this way. So then decided to drive myself off and try to figure out, okay, what does it look like to adapt in the era of climate change? What does it look like to grow food? But not just adaptation, right? There are all these companies around the world that are kind of excited about climate change because they can make a lot of money. So, you know, Alcoa is a steel company, and they've designed this steel for skyscrapers that can bend in the wind. Well, that's a huge money maker. We need to adapt,
right.
But we also need to mitigate. Like, it's sexy. Like, I've got to help be a solution to climate change while I'm also trying to adapt. So my adaptation strategy was lifting my farm off bottom and using the entire water column to be less susceptible to storm surges, and far enough below the surface so that I wouldn't get hit by heavy
hurricanes.
Waves.
Yeah.
Hurricanes, exactly. And then asked myself, what are all the species I can grow in a 20-acre area that are restorative? So, not just sustainable species, but species that breathe life back into our oceans while we're growing food and feeding the planet at the same time. And so that was sort of the box I made for myself. So instead of, because what aquaculture's always done is grown, say, salmon and tunas, because that's what everybody wants to eat. And that's exactly what we don't want to do, is follow the existing markets, because those markets were built up around an industrial wild fishery.
Right.
What we need to do is ask the oceans, what can we grow in you, and then shift taste. That's not going to be easy, but that's what it's going to require.
So if we want to just press pause here, and everybody, my listeners, know that I just show up as me, when someone on my show says something like, we want to ask the oceans what you can do, it's a total mindset shift. It's not, how can we make money off of your bounty? It's like, what can you give to us that we can help populations? This could be an answer to helping civilization. So this is why I'm in the Brent Smith fan club. Let us go on. And so,
it's a small fan club. I got to tell you,
I don't think so. But what about the, so it's literally like an underground garden, yes?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, like an underwater garden, yep.
And so, like a garden, are there seasons when things bloom or when they're ripe and you pick them? Or how does the harvest year look like when you have a farm underwater?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, let's just paint a picture because it helps, because it is strange. I mean, I always, I run these eco tours. People pay all this money to come on out, and it's like there's kind of nothing to see because it's all underwater. I would say it's the biggest ripoff in the tourist industry.
Good to know.
Exactly. I'm still a hustler despite it all, you know. So just like picture an underwater garden, and in the edges of the farm, it's 20 acres, there are anchors, these hurricane-proof anchors with ropes, basically just going up to the surface to a buoy. And then across, about 8 feet below the surface, are horizontal ropes.
Okay.
And from there, we grow our seaweeds, our kelp, vertically downwards. We attach to the ropes and grows down, and then we grow mussels in what we call mussel socks, also on those lines, scallops in lantern nets, and then down below the farm we have our oysters up off the bottom in cages, and then clams down in the mud.
What
you gotta remember about
vertical
growing
farming
in the ocean is, we don't have to fight gravity, right? So you just put this simple, cheap scaffolding system, and then you just use that to do all your vertical farming. So what the season looks like, we're in the middle of kelp season right now. I'm out It's a wonderful time of year because everybody disappears and it's just me and my boat. It's my favorite time. But I mean, you know, I can't swim. So it's always this. My mom's passed away now, but winter was always her time that she just always worrying about me, calling me all the time, stuff like that. But so anyway, so it's kelp season. And the way kelp works is, to seed it, we go out and get a couple pieces of kelp just locally. We only grow native species, and we take it back to our hatchery and we release spores. And the spores, it's amazing. They stick to string. So we just have string wrapped around pieces of, pipe in these tanks, and the spores grow out for a little while, about 2 or 3 weeks, and then we take those pieces of pipe, the string, and just wrap it around our horizontal ropes, and then that's it. The beautiful thing about ocean farming is you don't need to feed it, you don't need to fertilize it, you don't need to water it. It's like the laziest fishery or farming ever because it's zero inputs, right? And this zero input is really key for a whole bunch of reasons. One, as the water crisis escalates, as fertilizer and feed prices go up, which they already are, it makes our kinds of farming, zero-input farming, the most affordable food to grow on the planet, right? As all the prices go up for water and feed fertilizers, it's so cheap, which means we can pass those savings. So in the economics of this is going to go our way. 30 years from now, everybody's going to be eating some sort of zero-input food, right, at the center of their plate. I don't doubt that at all, and we're lucky that this zero-input food is also the most sustainable food on the planet. Anyway, so that's kelp seed. Then kelp we harvest starting right around April and May and June, and then what happens is mussels come through and automatically they love the little stems of kelp that are left over on the line, and the mussels stick to those little stems. They grow out, and then we put those in the mussel sucks, grow those till the fall, and harvest before kelp season. Scallops are the same season as mussels. And then the oysters are much more slow growing. They take 18 months to 2 years to grow down on the bottom, and they're more labor intensive. So we do that at a smaller scale, and clams, they take even longer, they're about 3 years. But the beautiful thing is we can be harvesting something year round. It diversifies risk. And, and to our folks who like to buy from us, we can always be providing a different thing in the sea basket.
And it provides year-round impact, and you're not so beholden to one thing and getting wiped out. I mean, talk about green jobs and a sustainable model. You know, when I'm reading it, it's like, so there's no there's no down season. You don't have to be worried about hurricanes. I mean, there's so many pieces to this. And, you know, we're going to have to go to break in about 2 minutes. But before we go to break, and even maybe after, so the 20-acre farm, like, is the ocean free? I don't know how to ask this question. Like, can you just go out? You know what I mean? Like, just go out. It's prime real estate. You can go out and put 20 acres on the ocean. Yeah. Is that right?
Well, so there are leases, but we don't own that water. We own, we pay $25 to $50 an acre per year, so it's really cheap. But what we own is the right to grow shellfish seaweed. Anybody can boat swim or fish over the farm. You can commercially fish. You can do whatever you want. We own a process right, not a property right. That's really important because our oceans are the commons. And we can keep them in the commons while also we're engines of restoration.
So it's so non-intrusive. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
I'm kind of reeling from, and you really took me aback when you said you can't swim. It's like, what? This is a man who spends all the time in the ocean? I think I learned to swim before I learned to walk because I grew up on a creek in New Jersey. And man, we were swimming literally about the same time that we could walk in here. I might hashtag that, Bryn Smith can't swim. So we have to really...
Well, most fishermen, northern fishermen can't swim.
Unreal.
It's actually a very common thing.
Not a well-known fact. And I think maybe I'm the first one to cover that. So we're going to go to a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about things like, you know, you've explained how it... I want to explain how it becomes 3D fishing and talk about a little bit. You can think about this on our 30-second break. are there threats from climate change? Like, what could happen? And then we have to really spend a lot of time talking about kelp. I'm going to put in my title for the show, kelp is the new kale, because I watched a couple of those videos and I have to ask you what it tastes like. So everybody, I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. Stay here with me. We'll be right back with Bryn Smith, Thimble Island Ocean Farm and Executive Director of GreenWave. Lots more good stuff to share. Stay here with me.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being with us. Joining us for this hour is Bryn Smith, owner of Thimble Island Ocean Farm and executive director of GreenWave. Bryn pioneered the development of restorative 3D ocean farming, which we are learning all about. It's mind-boggling and hope-giving. He's a lifelong commercial fisherman. His work has been profiled. And I have to say some of this because I love it when I do this list and say, and Mrs. Green's World, but CNN, The New Yorker, NPR, Bon Appetit, National Geographic Television, Future of Food, The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, New York Times, I mean, you name it, and The Atlantic. And then I feel like I got to meet a rock star before I knew all that. And then you tell me that you're not doing anything big, blah, blah, blah. No playing small on Mrs. Green's World. I am here to pump you up. And it's really been, it's just such a pleasure. And like I said, I haven't been in the greatest of moods this year so far, without making the show political, but there's pretty daunting news if you're an environmentalist when someone sets out to destroy things like the EPA and the Endangered Species Act. So your work to me just, it just magnifies so much in terms of its importance. So you literally, you have a process right for the farms that you have. And, you know, not expensive. That's the thing that I was thinking about. You don't have to have $250,000 to start your farm if you're thinking about doing this. And then another plus I thought about on the break is year-round income, which matters. It's not a seasonal income. So there's just so much this as an economic model and not impacting the sea, but helping it maintain its health. So you don't see your job as saving the seas, but you do see your job as spreading this technology, correct?
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of two pieces of technology. One is, Mother Nature created these technologies that can mitigate a huge amount of our harm, like oysters and, shellfish and seaweed. So, oysters filter up to 50 gallons of water a day. A single farm literally filters millions of gallons of water, and that pulls nitrogen out of the water column. In fact, if you were to take a network of farms totally under 10% of Long Island Sound, it would mitigate all the nitrogen pouring into the sound from human factors. And then our kelp soaks up to five times more carbon than land-based plants. The New Yorker called it the sequoia of the sea. So it's wonderful carbon sink. And then the farms also function as artificial reefs. So over 150 species come to, hide, eat, and thrive. Actually, the best fishing in the entire area. And duck hunting is on our farm now. And then they also, because it's a barrier, if they function as storm surge protectors, just slowing the impact of the farms. We were actually talking last year with the Navy about putting a farm in one of their big, huge tanks, where their tidal tanks actually measure the benefits of it. And actually, there's a tribe up in Maine that's about to do a kelp farm to protect their like docks and things like that, just to slow down some of the impact. But the one of the things here, I mean, close to my heart is that all sorts of folks from all different walks of life, right, make this accessible. So we can, you know, we designed it around ultimate simplicity. So anybody with 20 acres and a boat, and now I've got it down to $10,000, can start their own farm, be growing it this year. It's like the nail salon model of the sea, minimal capital requirements, minimal skill requirements, and that's the secret recipe for replication. But this isn't just small scale. One of the troubles with the new food economy is that it's too boutique. It's like bearded Brooklyn bee farmers and, you know, on roofs doing it. And that's wonderful. I mean, it's just great. But we're not going to feed the planet in the era of climate change that. Our farms, you can grow 10 to 20 tons of seaweed per acre, 250,000 shellfish. If you're going to take a network of our farms totaling the size of Washington State, you can technically feed the world. So we need to think big, not like big factory farms, but big right. network production that right. creates lots of jobs, lots of food, lots of opportunity. And one of the other thing we did is we open sourced this on purpose so that, you know, rather than, you know, I think that the tools of the old economy are patenting and things like that, and for it, licensing and forcing people to pay for it. We want to create jobs. We want people to have their own farms. And so we open sourced it. And I think that's been really successful because right now we have 11th generation fishermen starting a farm. We got a third generation lobsterman. I have Iraq vets. I've got an indigenous family. And one of the most surprising things, I have all these young land-based farmers who can't afford land right. and the infrastructure growing land coming to me. And I didn't expect that. So we now have requests to start farms in every coastal state in North America and 20 countries around the world. Now, I cannot, at scale this. We're just a couple people.
Yeah, you can't. How are you going to scale this?
Yeah, I mean, it keeps me up at night. But it shows that I think people feel, in this very troubling era, they feel some agency here. I mean, that's a deficit we all have. You feel like you got to be at Google to do something good in this because the problems are so big. Here's a way that you can soak up carbon, nitrogen, feed your community, create jobs all on 20 acres. It just feels possible for the individual. And that I think that's been proven just by the number of people that are headed our way.
And how are you going to scale it? So you're basically doing a trainer model. So you do it, you have trainers, and that's what GreenWave does. That's one of the functions of GreenWave, right, is to help exactly. train people and get them started. And are people coming from all over the world to get trained?
Well, I mean, I'm a terrible fundraiser, like absolutely, like on the nonprofit side. Actually, I've been courting this wealthy Wall Streeter for quite a while, and I ended up taking them out to dinner, and I was going to do that big ask, you know, after I'd been talking to them for months. And I just couldn't get it. I couldn't do a dollar. Like, I just couldn't do it. And then the check came, and it was this really expensive restaurant, and I did my Irish thing. I just lunged for the check and said I'd pay, and it was like a $700 dinner. So I'm the only fundraiser that actually loses money when they go try to fundraise.
Oh, my gosh.
So I say that to say that we want to do as many people as possible. We it's always a challenge. We do online, you know, fundraising campaigns. We have some great foundations supporting us. But what GreenWave does, and we really have a hybrid model. So GreenWave, the nonprofit, trains and educates. It does policy development for good ocean planning, and then does R&D to sort of stay ahead of the climate curve by working with scientists and other institutions. Now, the farmer training program, what you get is you get a small grant. You get free seed for 3 years. You get gear from Patagonia, which is a sponsor of ours.
That's great.
You get access. Yeah, they've been just absolutely wonderful. I spent 3 days with Yvonne, the CEO, and he's just been a wonderful, wonderful supporter and real visionary. And then we get some pro bono lawyers that can help folks like set up LLCs and do negotiations, whatever. And then probably the most important thing is our for-profit side agrees to buy 80% of what farmers grow for 3 to 5 years at triple the market rate. And that's what, because that's the trouble. You grow all this weird stuff. Where are you going to sell it? Well, we're able to, and so Seagreen Farms is the hybrid. It's the other side of Greenwave that does the really capital intensive infrastructure. Because when you farm the ocean, it's cheap. When you hit land, it's expensive,
yeah,
right? That's
yep.
the challenge. So the for-profit builds that infrastructure and does the market development while Greenwave is training and increasing supply. And I just found that sort of creating that sort of hybrid ecosystem has really been the way to go. And then the other thing on scaling, I'll say, so you know, we train the farmers. They're agreeing that they've got to commit to sustainability. They can only use native species. They have to open up to inspections like twice a year. And they have to agree to share all their learnings and train other people. Like people come to us and they want to do it and then just sort of keep it all private. We say, you know, it's great. You want to try this out. But we believe this is a time of shared learning experimentation, not of competition amongst farmers, right? And so that's been and so we have our farmers out training other folks, so that's wonderful. And then we're just right now developing an online manual called The Underwater Gardener. So if we do it right, anybody will be able to get it and then, you know, start their own farm. And then we'll probably be doing, you know, weekly Skype calls where anybody can call and ask a question. So this is how we're exploring and trying to figure out how to scale. We have some of the pieces, but it'll be an interesting challenge.
And just the fact that you have it be the way it's set up is for open source. To me, it's like that's it. That's the whole story about how you're doing it to make a difference and to help with jobs, like really good, sustainable jobs where people can make a very decent living. And it's not all about you creating this big company. And I'm telling you, I'll never forget the story now about you going out with the potential donor and you picked up the tab. I can relate to that. I'll tell you that right now. It's like, okay, you just, that's our Irish pride. This from this Murphy girl. It's like, nope, I'm paying for this.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about, you have a really interesting part on your website that I love, and it's a great website, about rearranging the seafood plate, because all of this, what you're doing, has to lead somewhere. So how are you trying to, or are you, reframing our thinking about what's on the seafood plate?
Yeah, so it's been, I'm not a foodie. Right? I eat it like the gas stations most nights. Right? And that's not a bad thing, right? The food movement and the food tent, you don't have to have a food fetish, right? I mean, heart disease and Alzheimer's are coming my way. That's fine, right?
No.
But we've really, and so my goal, and this is challenging, we're taking kind of the most disgusting thing and trying to make it delicious, right? You know, I wouldn't get caught, you know, dead eating kelp. But what I'm lucky here is that this is the great renaissance of, you know, American cuisine. And it's just a beautiful moment to be working with the chefs. And quite honestly, if the chefs can't take what I grow, which is what our ecosystem can provide,
right,
and they can't make it delicious and beautiful, they should quit their jobs. I mean, this is why they're on Earth, is to take challenges like this and make it just gorgeous and yummy stuff. So there's just been all this work with chefs for many, many years in this, and I started out wrong. I started out doing like little kelp cocktail events, and it was like a great way to meet my wife, but it's not the way to make the Gordon's fish stick of the future, right? So what in a broad sense, what we're trying to do is move bivalves and ocean greens to the center. That's how we're thinking about it. You know, it's like an arugula, like a kale. Move those to the center and wild fish to the edges, just like beef should be, you know, a treat, like a sacred treat. We have once a month, wild fish should eventually get there too, right?
And the thing I thought about is like kelp is the new kale. That's what I'm going to start saying. Kelp is the new kale,
exactly.
Which I also find quite disgusting to eat. And I'm Mrs. Green, and people say, what do you mean? You don't like kale? I'm like, no, I don't like kale. So maybe I'll try kelp.
Well, here's the thing. You put it into brilliant hands and it totally changes. Like I was giving it to seafood chefs, and they didn't know what to do. All they were doing was like wrapping around stuff, doing seafood salads, you know, putting fish in it, stuff like that. And that's all great, but I gave it to Brooks Headley in New York City. He runs Superiority Burger, and he's one of the great, like, you know, he's brilliant with vegetables. And he came up immediately with barbecue kelp noodles, parsnips, and breadcrumbs.
Oh my gosh.
Like, that is it. Then you figure out, oh, it's not seafood, it's a vegetable. And you need to think of it that way. And then you need the, like, crunches and the nuttiness and stuff like that to bring to it. And it's just delicious. Now, this isn't just about kelp, right? I mean, this is the beginning of what I hope to be almost like a Manhattan-level project about sea vegetables, because there are 10,000 edible plants in the ocean. 10,000! And a couple hundred kinds of shellfish. There's something we can grow everywhere. And if, you know, imagine being a chef in 2017 and learning there are like arugulas, kales, corns, rices, tomatoes, whatever that you've never seen before. 10,000. I mean, it's just a stunning chance. So what an exciting time to develop. While I'm climate farming, they're developing a climate cuisine, and it's not all bad, you know, bad news. It's actually creative and exciting.
Yeah, 10,000, especially when you think about all of the issues around food security, food deserts, food safety. And I have to ask you a couple of things about that. So there are challenges with the ocean. You've got plastic pollution, all kinds of other things. Are these creatures, and in the infinite wisdom of Mother Earth, are they impervious to some of those poisons and toxins? So you're still eating something safe? Like, my question is, can kelp be, you know, contaminated by something in the sea that isn't supposed to be there?
Yeah.
Does that question make sense?
Yeah, completely. And we think of it in two ways. One is farming for food, and the other is farming for pollution. And now, farming for food, it's an issue of traceability, regulation, good science, where we just, you know, we have the most traceable regulated food in the country because we're growing shellfish. Oysters are a live product that people eat. It's the only one that, a live product that folks in the U.S. generally eat. So, and we embrace that. So we put our seaweeds and everything in that same regulatory regime. So we're tested just all the time. We know from seed all the way to plate, time temps, everything. It's really rigorous. So we grow in pristine waters there. And then we do, I will say, so plastics and stuff, seaweeds don't soak those up.
Okay.
They soak up heavy metals for sure. Now, that's so what we do is just in waters that aren't appropriate to grow in, we grow anyway, but not for food. We grow it, well, that's what I think of as pollution farming. In the Bronx River, we have all these, we're starting to create underwater gardens, like community gardens in places that will just soak up heavy metals as well as nitrogen and carbon. So they improve waterways, don't go in the food system, but it can be used for biofuels. So we're working with the Department of Energy. I don't know what's going to happen now. But with the Department of Energy, because kelp has it's 6 times more ethanol than corn per acre. So and it's zero input. So biofuels are problematic because of land-based biofuels, because of the water and the, you know, all the different uses.
Right.
That's not the, so we can take that dirty, dangerous stuff and turn it into fuel. So I think we just need to change the way we think about the agriculture on the ocean. It just doesn't just need to be food, but it needs, quite honestly, in the era of the threat to the EPA and different stuff, this could ruin my job. I mean, Trump wants to create jobs. Doing environmental remediation, fighting climate change, could be the biggest job creator ever we've seen in history. Like, this World War II and mitigating climate change can completely revive, create a middle-class economy again, and address inequality. If we do the opposite and we get rid of the EPA, don't tackle climate change, acidification, rising water temperatures, my industry, which is a nascent industry that could create thousands of completely new jobs, won't be possible. And that's what, like the real job killer is climate change and environmental deregulation. That's what we have to fight for. This isn't about jobs versus environment. That's a false choice. It's jobs and the environment, and that's like an exciting place that I sit with everybody else in the climate movement, folks doing solar on Navajo reservations, urban gardeners in Detroit, things like that. That's where I belong. It's like a politics of, yes, we stop pipelines, or we build something that helps, feed the needs of local people, both economic and nutritional.
And real jobs, like real sustainable jobs with a good income. So we're up on another break. We have lots more to share. I, of course, have lots more questions. And everybody, stay here with me. Brent, I loved what you said. I want to ask my team to take that clip of what you just said about the absolute idiocy of not being in favor of mitigating climate change. It doesn't make sense for any of us as citizens of the planet. Everybody stay right here with me. Lots of really good stuff in the last segment with Bren Smith.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And thank you for being a part of our world. We're spending this hour with Bren Smith, who's the owner of Thimble Island Ocean Farm, an executive director of Green Wave, and very fun and a wild and crazy guy. I'm using all of my throwback to the 60s terms. But Bren pioneered the development of 3D restorative 3D ocean farming. He's been called a visionary. I'm not even going to go through all of the things that you've been called, because I said them and they're all true and they're under exaggerated as far as I'm concerned. So let's embarrass you. I wonder about things like, and I'm not quite sure how to say it, but with climate change, like if the oceans warm 2 degrees, I know that entire oyster beds are being wiped out on the West Coast and up in Washington and Oregon, and they're not even sure why. So is this something that, will it impact the ability of the species to reproduce, and will it wipe out species? Do you know about that, looking through the looking glass for the future?
Yeah, I mean, you know, on our current trajectory, we're all going to burn, starve, and drown. I mean, you know, like, there's just no question
there's
about it.
There's a positive outlook if we don't wake up. Yeah, good. We're all going to burn, starve, and drown.
The only good thing about life is that it's short, right? I mean, there's a whole other non-hopeful philosophy that we can encourage. But land-based agriculture is really in crisis, and we really need to stay sort of ahead of the curve on the ocean. I mean, with corn prices are expected to go up, spike up at that 140% in the next 15 years. I mean, it's just like absolutely stunning. But when we look at the waters, we're going to face the same challenges. So already this year, I'm looking at the warmest winter I've ever seen.
Right.
With, you know,
right.
60 degrees right now, which is insane. My kelp is a winter crop, right? If temperature, and I'm at the southern region, and we have farms all the way throughout New England, and we're starting in California as well. The key is distributed production. But there's no question water temps could affect it. Acidification affects not my kelp, but it affects the oysters. Where my hope comes from is, because this is so unexplored, 10,000 edible plants, a couple hundred different kinds of shellfish, we can go into every ecosystem, warm or cold, and ask what are all the restorative native species we can grow, and then use this simple farming infrastructure, architecture, to do that. But that's going to take serious investment. I mean, we need, this is why I work so closely with NOAA, with Woods Hole, UConn, Yale, University of Santa Barbara, stuff like that, because I need the scientists desperately.
Right.
And we need kind of all hands on deck. I need chefs, I need policymakers, economists, I need farmers, I need students. and need scientists to really do this. And that's why this, you know, I'm no supporter of the atom bomb, but the Manhattan Project of saying, okay, let's figure out, let's look at all 10,000 of these plants, and let's look at the nutritional profiles, let's figure out the genetics of it, things like that, and so we can create new sources of food.
It's a really big job. That's a really big job. Like, how do we... But it's the, like I said, I wasn't kidding, the whole green enchilada, because with your success, there's not the pesticides, that all the problems with soy and corn and the things that are polluting the earth, the energy, okay? So how much energy does it take to put these things up? You're not creating massive amounts of energy. And then the fertilizers, you know, you're saving the oceans and all of the mitigation of the, what did you say, the nitrogen. I mean, there, it just keeps going on and on and on, the potential. And feeding the hungry.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just two things, which is, I'm worried a whole section of the environmental movement are actual climate deniers. And I don't mean this as really insulting. It's more, we all believe climate change is real. It's just the impacts haven't sunk in. So in my world, the oceans, the big push is to create conservation zones, which are wonderful, right? Parks all through the oceans is sort of a Teddy Roosevelt environmentalism. The trouble is, in the era of climate change, you could set aside the entire world's oceans as a marine park and they're all going to die. One out of four marine species are expected to die unless we tackle climate change in the next like 50 to 100 years. We need to farm the ocean in order to restore it. So you can have marine parks, but you need small-scale ocean farms there to breed life into those farms. And that, if unless you move into out of a conservation-only strategy and into figuring out what are the new, like, both opportunities and ways how we need to change our thinking because of climate change. So in a way, this sector of environmentalists aren't environmentalists anymore because they're not confronting the biggest challenges that we face. The other thing I want to say about seaweeds is that it is like the soy of the sea, but it's not evil. So the soy industry in 1950s said we're never going to get Americans to eat soy, so what we're going to do is put soy in everything. Now, the interesting thing about kelp is that it's a thickener, it's a land-based fertilizer. I've got a program at the Yale Sustainable Food Project to do fertilizers. It's an animal feed. The studies coming out of Australia, if you give a majority diet of seaweed to cattle, you get, this is a stunning number, 90% reduction in methane output because it changes their stomach. And in fact, cattle have been eating kelp for hundreds of years in the Hebrides Islands, in Maine, in Peru, all these different places. And it creates this delicious, like, kind of salt marsh, umami-packed beef. So, and then there's biofuel and there's pharmaceuticals. So if the exciting thing for me is I'm starting on food, but there's an entire triangle of value that we can, you know, use for, like, whatever waste I create, I have tons of uses for it, whether I do it fertilizer, do it for chicken feed, all sorts of things. So that's, I think that's the really, you know, for me, that's the challenge for me is how to get out of this smaller sort of farmer's market box, which I, you know, do the farmer's market, I really support it. But in the era of climate change, we just need to think at huge, huge scale.
And accelerate the process. I mean, and the other thing that I thought about when I was doing this, I mean, there are so many dead zones in the ocean from overfishing and all of those things. This is the opposite, the quintessence of the opposite of preventing those dead zones from occurring, because you're literally putting ocean farms in that, you know, sequester the nitrogen and capture the resources in that area. I mean, it goes on and on. You know, I just want to observe that I was at Green Biz last week for 3 days with Joel McCower and all of those thought leaders. I mean, it was like I went into the green heaven bubble. You know what I mean? I didn't look at any news. I'm like, okay, there's hope. And one of the things that I will tell you I will pursue is quite a few of the speakers talked about, you know, the green economy is here to stay. And this one guy said that he had someone call him the other day, and he had $5 billion he wanted to invest in the green economy. And he said, and at this point, I didn't even know where to put it. Well, I might find out who it was, give him a call and say, have I got a person for you to look at? And you know what? I'm barely kidding. I mean, you're right. Yeah. It does take money to make money. But what you need to do is figure out a way to scale this so that it can have an impact of the vision that you have in a hurry. Like, we got to hurry here, folks. I feel like, you know, Croc in Peter Pan, where the crocodile is coming closer and it's getting louder. It's like tick, 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 tick.
I mean, there's huge opportunity to, I mean, because there's all these secondary pieces. So,
yes.
I mean, Green Wave, our idea of scaling is what I think of as a Green Wave Reef, which is 50 farms in an area, you know, wide region,
a seafood hub
and a hatchery and land in a poor neighborhood. Our first processing facility is one of the poorest neighborhoods on the East Coast. A ring of institutional buyers. So we work with Google, places like that, universities, and then a ring of entrepreneurs doing everything from kelp jerkies to fertilizers and feeds. And then you take that Green Wave Reef and you replicate it every 200 miles. But it's not just that. So we have plans, but we don't have, we need, since there's kind of no government funding in any significant way, we've got designs from mobile hatcheries that we're able to fit in shipping containers and drop anywhere. We've got plans for a solarized and wind-powered harvesting and seeding boats. Because we don't have to chase things. We're just floating around the water. We can really leverage the technology. Well, that's all these shipbuilding jobs along our coast, but it really does. I've done this sort of early stage, open source, low cost innovation.
Right.
Now the larger scaling network production is going to require investment. So that's where the end of, you know, I'm just a poor guy and we're young. I know what to do with billions, but I can point to stuff, but I'm not I can't raise that kind of money.
Well, at some point you can be literally the really good orchestra leader because you know what has to be done and you know the oceans and you're connected to them. And that's so very real. And to me, the brilliant investor will come and say to you, I hope that you enjoy that I'm giving you this money and do with it what you can, because it just, I mean, I can put that out there for you and hope that it happens and see if there's a way that I get connected. I mean, and I'm serious. I'm a big green dot connector in my time off the air. So what about right now? Do you have many more people that are coming that want to be trained and become apprentices than you have the capacity to grow?
So just in California, after the Bioneer speech, we walked away with over 100 people that wanted to start farms. That was after one day of revolution. Yeah, we have thousands. Like, it's my hugest, I basically break people's hearts all, like, it's killing me, because everyone writes in with stories about why they want to do this, their path. It's just this very emotional space, and it's just, it's killing me. We have a plan to scale, but it's, you know, it's funny. In 10 years, if I'm still the face of this, I'll have failed. The goal here is for me to push this, train lots of other people, other spokesmen. There's such powerful stories out there. Have them take the lead, both in promotion, but also in innovating. Like, if I want to go out to a farm in 10 years and barely recognize it because it's been, you know, the other fishermen and land-based farmers have just really innovated on top of that, then I can fade back into, you know, back to being a farmer is where I belong. I think I said it by years. Yeah, you know, my hope is I never have to go to California again. that's my goal. One last thing, is just because it's very close to my heart, is that because the oceans are a blank slate, we're building this economy from the ground up. It is essential that we weave food justice into the DNA of this new industry. And I think we're really trying to think through, but need to make a lot of progress on what that looks like. At minimum, are placing our land-based infrastructure in communities that didn't benefit from the Industrial Revolution, that have been left behind, is what we start with. We're starting wages of $15 an hour. We have open employment. I don't care if you're undocumented. I don't care if you're a former felon. We're going to figure out a way to work together. But I want to push it further than that, and this is where I think it's going to take more community organizing. We've had some success, but again, I'm going to have to push the resources here, which is going out to find people that have no, like in inner cities and other places, folks that have, like I said, didn't benefit from the Industrial Revolution, right, and put them in the front of the line. And the key there is then they're not working for us then. They're starting their own farms. They have they're self-directed. They have their own businesses. They're not just wage earners. And that's what's exciting because, like I said before, agency, having power over your own life, I think is something that we all need. And that's a core element of food justice.
It's you know, again, I if anybody that knows me that's listening to this show, and there are a lot of people, the fourth pillar, which is social justice, the four pillars of sustainability, has been my focus. Like for this, yeah, it's now the focus. And when you go to something like Bioneers and you are educated about marginalized community, and I went to Social Venture Network, that was another one that was amazing. So the poor get screwed, excuse my crass expression, over and over and over. And we bring the railroads through their towns with the most toxic chemicals being transported and on the oil pipelines. So your model to me, I mean, it's got it all because social justice is huge. And again, when you say $10,000, most people can figure out a way through family or their own resources to do it. It's not that that goal that can never be attained, and you have to get venture capital partners and sell your soul for the whole thing. I have no doubts about it. You better stay healthy and not go on any rough seas when you can't swim, for God's sake. It's like, come on, bro.
I'm the hurricane with a Big Mac burger.
Oh my God.
That's how I'll go.
You know, those are our dirty little secrets, because I do, like, I when I eat beef, I feel like it's a moral lapse, okay? So there is one place in Tucson where it's, you know, I call it guilt-free burgers, and they have, I know the farm that these cows are raised on, I know the family that raises them, I know what they're fed, and there's not, because they're fed healthy, it's not the whole methane production. So I do go to Gray's Burgers and say, okay, this is my beef treat. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But I was telling somebody last night, instead of having, you know, there's meatless Mondays, there should be meat Mondays. And all the other days there should be, I mean, we should turn that little thing around too.
And, you know, we did with Google up a 40% kelp, 60% beef burger. And we started the Google Food Conference, and it was a huge hit. You know, we can begin, this can be a transition or a combination of good and good in the same, you know, in the same meal. And it really was, because you got that umami that you get from kelp sort of underneath the beef, and it was just delicious.
Well, I mean, that's a new one. I got to admit, you're hearing it here on Mrs. Green's World of what you're going to do. But the interest that you have from almost every cool organization that I know of, from, you know, the big dogs about Patagonia and the really big publications that you're being featured in, and, you know, Oceana, that was one of my most fun interviews ever with Ted Danson. I had to get him off the air because his handler said he could only do 30 minutes, and when he got on the show, he wanted to do an hour. But, you know, and Fast Company and all of those things, there's no doubt in my mind that we have to hurry up and get you overfunded so that you can really imitate. And I mean, at Bioneers, I had to wait almost like 45 minutes to even get to someone standing close to you about interviewing you on the show, because you were swarmed. I mean, it was people, and I heard your answers, people asking, how can I do this? I want to do it out here. And your patience and your, that whole down to earth Bren Smith was really out there in abundance. So I want to tell everybody before we get off the air, because sometimes I forget these really important pieces, that you can find all about this at greenwave.org. I encourage you to. It's a really wonderful website. You just want to go down the rabbit hole. Facebook is greenwave.org. Twitter is greenwave.org. And you never know, there might be one of my listeners that has access to venture capital or investors, and take that seriously. Get your green on and, you know, contact me and we'll figure it out. You never know what happens. And then very quickly, two upcoming shows. One of my favorites is anything we're doing with Goodwill Industries, because they keep so much out of landfills. Judith Simmons and Lori Marrero about spring cleaning and decluttering. And then we have Natasha Rohatky and Alan Thompson from Bosch on the show about all of the things they're doing to make products that last and are not, you know, engaged in planned obsolescence. So, Bren Smith, what an honor and privilege to spend this hour with you. You rock. Really mean it.
It was an honor to be on. I'm going to listen to those other shows. Sound great. I'm going to throw my podcast and pretend to run.
You would love some of my podcasts. I'm seriously. So, everybody, make it a great green day and get ready for the slogan, kelp is the new kale. Bren Smith, thanks for coming, showing up in my life.
No problem. Thanks so much.
Okay, take care.
Bye.